Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome to the Dr. Karen Cam Radio Show. The intention of this show is to empower and inspire you to manifest the life of your dreams, whether it's radiant health, prosperity, loving relationships, or simply peace of mind. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm your host, Dr. Karen Cam. And today with me, I have Dr. Larry Birkelhammer. Now, let me tell you a little bit about his story, which was very interesting to me, and I think it's going to be just as inspiring to you as it was for me when I read about it. So Dr. Birkelhammer was about 53, and he was diagnosed with several different diseases. He was suffering from all sorts of chronic conditions, and so finally he got a few diagnoses from his doctors. One was ankylosing spondylitis. There was also subclinical inflammatory bowel disease, immune thrombocytopenic purpura, don't say that three times fast, it's pretty tough, and also primary combined immunodeficiency disease. So that is a lot. Going on in one person. And here's the thing. He already was eating a very nutrient-dense diet, so he wasn't, you know, a couch potato. He was exercising more than an hour a day. He made sure he slept 6 to 8 hours a night. He had practiced some form of meditation for almost 30 years, and so he had what many of us consider would be the perfect lifestyle, and yet he still had these diagnoses. So he thought to himself, well, there must be something else. And thanks to his experience and his research about the power of the mind, he was able to really heal himself, and now he teaches many, many people with chronic illnesses also how to tap in to their mind, actually mind train themselves to help their chronic illnesses, their symptoms, and even reverse disease. So without further ado, hello, Dr. Birkelhammer. Thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
All right. So how long did it take between the, you know, the starting to research more about the mind and when you figured out, wow, this is really helping me? How long did that take?
You know, it's a long, slow, gradual process. And I want to be clear that I have not succeeded in curing myself of anything. But what I have done is I've improved the quality of my life. So I've gone from feeling hopeless and depressed and helpless, and I've gone from that to taking back control of my life, feeling like I'm in complete charge of my life. And so when I was working with clients, and I've since retired, but my goal with everyone was not to cure them, because I don't have that power, but it was to help them learn how to become the team leaders of their healthcare team, help them feel like they're really in charge of their lives, to live with what I call mastery and well-being.
So it seems to me that many different masters and gurus out there, I have this, I guess, misconception years ago that, wow, you know, if somebody was a great teacher, they must be perfectly healthy. And then now I realize that sometimes through our own illnesses, through our own pain, that we can both develop compassion for other people and also kind of go into a deep discovery of what else is there. And it sounds like that's what happened to you, that you found a way to be at peace and joyous and happy despite, you know, not having the quote-unquote perfect, you know, body or perfect health. Do you feel that's
right?
True?
Yeah, and, you know, I felt that, well, since I had already been doing everything right, as you pointed out, my health care, my self-care was perfect. So I had, you know, what could I do to get better? The doctors had no answers. And I started studying the field of psychoneuroimmunology, or the interplay between the mind and the immune system, and I realized that our state of mind has enormous power over our physiologic functioning. So as important as it is to eat the right diet, to exercise enough, to sleep enough, to practice stress management, all those things are not enough. There's more that we can do, and the more is the most difficult piece, because there is a lot of research showing that optimistic attitudes are strongly associated with better health. But how do we become more optimistic if we're in, if we're living with pain every day, or if we're living with chronic fatigue or malaise, just feeling, not feeling well and not being able to do all the things we love to do in life? It's pretty hard to be optimistic. So what I've done is I've looked at what is the research that shows, you know, what can we do that leads to being able to be optimistic in the face of ill health, in the face of suffering. And one of the terms that's currently very popular is resilience. And a lot of people who have had very traumatic life experiences ride through it just fine, and other people deal with post-traumatic stress disorder. So I began to wonder, well, what's different between the people who suffer with PTSD and the people who sail through the trauma and live happy, healthy, optimistic lives? And the difference is it's about being in control of your life, finding some way to feel that you are in control of your life. And there are many, many things we can do to do that. One of them is to learn everything we can possibly learn about our own particular diagnosis. So that way, when we go in for medical appointments, we can speak intelligently with the doctor. We can ask better questions that are going to get answers that are going to help us more. Learning about our disease helps us know what have people already tried. So it's important to really become an expert on our particular diagnosis. So that's one thing. And then there are many, many practices we can do that help us train our minds to live in a happier state. And one of them, the one that I consider the foundation to everything else, is mindfulness practice. And for that, I recommend people, it's readily available today. You just go to, in pretty much every city on the planet, you just sign up for an 8-week MBSR class. MBSR stands for Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction. Or if you're near a Buddhist meditation center, you sign up for a weekend introductory workshop in mindfulness practice. That's the mindfulness is the starting place, in my view, that and becoming the expert on your own diagnosis. But then from there, there are many, many other things I can go into if you'd like.
Well, yeah, let's. I want to ask you about research as far as, you know, brain scans and that kind of stuff. If there's some evidence out there that this mindfulness training actually works, and what have you found?
Yeah, the probably the most well-known researcher is a research psychologist at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. His name is Richie Davidson, and he got talking to the Dalai Lama many years ago, and the Dalai Lama, of course, is very interested in science. And so they worked out an agreement where the Dalai Lama requested that monks living in Dharamsala, India, go to Wisconsin to have their brains studied. So they started flying monks into Wisconsin, and they would put the monks in an fMRI scanner and other scanners as well, and they would have them meditate while in the scanner. They would also have them do various mathematical challenges when they're in the scanner. They would have them practice various other things, like calling up an image of people they care about. They did extensive electroencephalography, EEG, studying the brain waves. And what they discovered is that the brains of the monks were more highly evolved than the brains of the rest of us. They were more highly evolved in both structure and function. And so some of us, you know, started reading this early research and got discouraged because these monks are sitting, they're meditating for most of the day, every day.
Mm-hmm.
So then they studied normal people who signed up for an 8-week MBSR class. And they studied, they did a brain scan of people before the 8-week class and at the end of the 8-week class. And they found that although the effect was much less, there was an improvement in, again, in both brain structure and function after just 8 weeks of practice.
Wow.
So when I saw that evidence, I started meditating more intensively than I'd ever meditated before.
Neat. Now, you say on your website that a mindfulness practice is different from, say, a meditation practice, although they both kind of can coexist together, of course. But can you, for our listeners, give definition for us?
I tend not to use the term meditation very much, only because there are so many different kinds of meditation that mm-hmm. when someone says meditation, it's hard to know what they're referring to. For example, when people pray, religious prayer is often referred to as meditation.
Right.
Concentration meditation, you know, like focusing on an object, is considered meditation. Mindfulness practice, or vipassana, is also meditation, but what's different about mindfulness practice is, so mindfulness is a form of meditation, but what's different about it is not only do you focus on an object, but you notice whenever your mind wanders away from the object of focus, which it does for everyone, you bring it back. But not only do you bring your attention back to the object of focus, in mindfulness you notice you note where your mind wandered off to, and you just kind of make note of that before returning to the object of focus. The beauty of mindfulness is that we all get caught up in our thoughts, you know, ruminating about things, you know, just obsessing about things, having anxiety, or, you know, depression is often just thinking, ruminating over and over about how things aren't working out well. So what mindfulness does is it allows us to recognize that these are just thoughts and that we don't have to obey the thoughts. We can see that, oh, there's a difference between my thoughts and reality. So I may have the thought that, you know, I may have all kinds of terrible judgmental thoughts, and that can make me very unhappy. You know, thoughts like, I'm not good enough, I don't measure up, I'm not lovable. These are common thoughts that we all have. The difference is, with mindfulness, we can say, we learn to get to a point where we can see that, oh, I'm punishing myself by telling myself all these thoughts. And they're not real. They're not based on fact. They're just thoughts that I've been practicing for so long that they seem like they're real, but they only seem real because I've been practicing them for so much of my life.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really the beauty of mindfulness.
Well, and then the, you know, mindfulness in our daily life can extend to everything, and right? I mean, you can extend to washing the dishes or playing
exactly.
with our child or.
That's right. And so, you know, one of the things that happens with mindfulness practice is we begin to become very aware of how often when we're engaged in another activity, our mind is not on that activity. Our mind, we're daydreaming. We're thinking about mm-hmm. something much more interesting. So mindfulness allows us to, what we do when we're doing formal meditation, in other words, returning to the object of focus, which is usually the sensations of respiration. It's usually feeling the expansion and contraction of the chest and abdomen as we breathe. So we begin, if we're doing the dishes, we begin to focus more on the dishes, and suddenly doing the dishes can be an interesting activity, an activity that would seem very mundane and boring, or vacuuming the house. Mm-hmm. You know, typically today, you see everyone going around hooked up to their iPods, listening to music they've downloaded. But, you know, and it's great to listen to music, but the thing is, or people are texting all the time because it's hard to be alone. And we live in a culture now where it's hard to be alone with our thoughts.
Yeah.
But if you actually spend some time alone with your thoughts, with no distractions, in other words, no music, no conversations with anyone, no TV, no books, no stimulation of any kind, only your thoughts, you begin to actually feel very alive, more alive than you do when you go around just engaged in distraction, whether it's music or TV, conversation, through texting or whatever. So the idea is to live fully in every moment. And that's how I got out of the helpless, hopeless depression that I was in when I realized that the doctors at this top-notch academic medical center I was going to had no cures for me, had no good treatments even for me, because one treatment would affect, a treatment for one illness would affect another illness. So I began to realize, okay, I guess the only thing I have left is to learn how to live fully in every moment, in whatever time I have left, whether I'm on the planet for just another year or for another 20 years, to live fully in every moment, to at least you know, enjoy moment to moment, and to even use it with pain. For example, if I'm in pain, the worst thing is I find myself catastrophizing. In other words, I find myself saying, oh, this pain is killing me. I'll never be able to enjoy anything again. That's what causes the depression. The pain itself doesn't cause the depression. It's my negative attributions that I assign to the pain. That's what makes me depressed. So with mindfulness, I've learned to recognize, okay, these negative attributions, these are just thoughts, and I can laugh at my thoughts. Now, this takes some practice, but
oh, yeah.
You know, it's a path. But it's at least a path that leads to feeling like we're in control of our lives, and it leads to much greater happiness.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned pain, Dr. Brookhammer, because I'm writing a book on, you know, Guide to Healing Chronic Pain. I talk about mindfulness and meditation in this. And what's really interesting is when I've been practicing mindfulness of different pain spots in my body, it's so interesting how the natural reaction, I think this is true of everyone, is to avoid it. So we think of something else, we focus on another point, and then I'm like, oh, wait a second, where am I? Okay, let's go back to my left shoulder, you know, and let's just feel what that feels like, and just letting go of all the judgment is what you were talking about earlier. All the judgments of this is bad, this is never going to get better, you know, and just being with the sensation and noticing the sensation without need for it to change. And often it does anyway, you know, but not being attached to whether it does or not. It's very, very interesting.
Yeah. We make, and the harder we try to get rid of the pain,
mm-hmm.
the more we suffer.
Yep. What we resist persists.
Exactly. That's a common expression. What we resist persists. Another expression that's similar to that is, if you don't want it, you'll have it.
Yeah. Well, and that goes for emotional pain as well. And I remember talking to a patient last week about it, and she, you know, she's upset over a few things, and it just keeps going on and on and on and on. And one of the things is that I felt she was actually resisting the experience of it, because when we feel it so intensely, it can feel like our life is over, that there's nothing else beyond that fear or beyond that pain. But when we keep pushing it away and distracting ourselves, it just seems like it keeps coming back. It keeps coming back because it just
exactly.
never gets to the
yeah.
other side.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. One of the other things that I found very helpful is it's really hard to experience living with chronic debilitating medical conditions alone. And we all need support. And whether that support comes from a spouse, a close friend, a family member, a support group, we have to have support. People, there have been a lot of studies showing that the quality and the quantity of support we have, emotional support that we have from others, is strongly associated with health. The people with the least amount of good emotional support tend to not be as healthy, tend to suffer much more than the people who have the most and the strongest emotional support.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I heard that, you know, having pets makes a difference too, even if it's not human.
That's right. Absolutely. I mean, pets, you know, especially dogs are, you know, they love you. The love they give you isn't conditional.
Right.
It's unconditional. And we all need unconditional love and acceptance. And we all need to be heard. We need to be understood. We need to be appreciated. You know, it's when we're dealing with chronic illness things, we need someone to really get it, what we're going through, and to not just try to cheer us up or to tell us, you know, what we should be doing. We need people who can truly listen. And most often that's people who know from personal experience, which is why support groups are often good, although support groups are often not good because sometimes people in support groups just sit around and complain about what's not working, and they're actually reinforcing all
right.
their negative attributions. So they need to be in a support group where they're helped to take control of their lives, where the skill-building type support groups.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to actually make the shift rather than staying in a victim-y kind of place.
It's really important to step out of, to find some way to climb out of that victim trap. And I've been there myself, and it's hard to climb out. But I found that probably at least as important as mindfulness is the support from understanding other, you know, other people who truly understand and are there to listen and support us.
Mm. So you mentioned earlier that if people, even if they, you know, take an 8-week mindfulness-based stress reduction program or something similar, that they can feel, or there's definitely changes that occur just from doing that. But what do you recommend to clients or patients or people wanting to do this for any chronic illness? Do you feel like they should do this practice every day, or is there a minimum?
It is. You know, it would be really so nice if we could just do it for 8 weeks and then we're fixed. I wish that were the case. Boy, do I wish that were the case, because I'm someone who hates anything that's called practice. I don't want it. But the reality is, I want things to be fun. I don't want the word practice. You know, I played trumpet when I was a kid, and I hated practicing. I wanted to jam because I played by ear. And anything called practice, whether it's music practice, athletic practice, dance practice, practice of, you know, any academic practice, who wants to practice? But the reality is, We lose the benefits really fast. You can go to an 8-week MBSR class, get a lot out of it, but after just a couple of weeks of not meditating anymore, not practicing mindfulness, the effects are almost all gone. It has to be a daily practice for the rest of our lives. That's the bad news. But the good news is, it does start getting easier. I found when I first started practicing Vipassana, which is now, well, I don't know, a long, long time ago, I practice was something I just dreaded, and now I look for every opportunity, and it doesn't have to be sitting on a special cushion or sitting on a special bench. because of my arthritis, I sit in a very firm, upright chair. Sometimes I'm practicing mindfulness and I'm walking when I'm when I'm doing the dishes all the time. The more we practice, the easier it gets, and the greater the benefits.
And I think it's such a great way to really contact that innate joy that we're all deserving of, just being here, being in the human experience. And it sounds like for you that, you've gotten to a place of great peace with your illnesses.
I've gotten to a place of great peace, and the other thing is, when we are in a state of mind where we feel like we're in charge of our lives, again, as I said earlier, optimism is just so important, but you can't pretend to be optimistic. People say, oh, just think positively. Well, people who say that, maybe life was just always easy for them, but if you're suffering, it's very hard to think positively. It just doesn't work. What we need to do is to take control of our lives through mastery practices, mindfulness practices, becoming experts in our own diagnoses and our own healthcare, making ourselves the team leader. I see several specialists at UCSF Medical Center, but I'm the team leader, and I know my body better than they know my body. So all these things come together, and that's how to live with greater happiness and greater hope and optimism, is we really need to take charge of our lives. It's not going to come from outside us. It's not going to come from drugs. It's an inside job.
Yeah, absolutely. I echo that 100%. That, Dr. Birkelheimer, we have about 3 minutes left. Do you want to share with people how they can get to know more about your work or how they can learn more about your mindfulness training?
So I run a website that's a non-commercial public service website. There are no ads on the website. I'm not selling anything. I'm not selling any products or services. It's purely I just am providing a ton of information for people living with chronic illness on all the different things they can do, which, of course, we can't cover in a half an hour. So my website is larrybirkelheimer.com. And I'll spell my name, LarryBirkelheimer.com. So I have a blog on there. I have interviews with other people and with myself. And on Fridays, I blog 3 times a week. Monday is an article I've written. Wednesday is an interview, a video interview. And Fridays is Q&A, where people can post a comment in the form of a question, and then I answer it at some point in a future week.
Oh, that's fabulous. Thank you so much. Well, our time's just about up. I just want to extend, just great gratitude for you for being here, for sharing your gifts, for sharing your wisdom, and you're an inspiration to us all, Dr. Birkelheimer.
Well, thank you, Karen, and I just really appreciate what you're doing. You're providing people with a lot of great information, just the way I'm doing.
Awesome. Well, we more light workers, the better, I like to
say.
All right. Thanks again so much, and thank you for all our listeners for listening to my interview with Dr. Birkelheimer today. Take care, everyone. Until next time. Bye for now.
Thank you.